So that's from 2010. Well, not sure if the original's from 2010. That's my version of it's Mood Swings, Spiritual High with Chrissy Hynde. And welcome back to Not the BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So he's the father of Julian Assange, but don't be surprised if you haven't heard his name. John Shipton's been almost ignored by the London media in this globally important case about freedom of the press. Do we have it or not? In an exclusive interview with him tonight, he talks about Julian's misspent youth, his hopes for the case, and the incredible UC Global case, where a private spying company revealed a US obsession with hacking right into Julian's life, every aspect of it, in the Ecuadorian embassy. And also, in case you hadn't noticed, it's the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks today. We hear from Arizona talk show host and former US Naval Intelligence Officer William Cooper. He was killed 8 weeks after the 9/11 attacks by undercover FBI agents. His show from the 28th of June 2001, that's 10 weeks before 9/11, all but predicts the 9/11 false flag attack on America and how that would be blamed on Osama bin Laden. He, by the way, Bill Cooper, was the prototype for doppelganger, that's what I call him, Alex Jones, who might sound familiar, and he actually sounds like a kind of similar kind of shock jock, US shock jock, broadcasting from neighbouring Texas. But Jones has none of the military insight, except that which is fed from Rita Katz and the Mossad, and just uses his show now to bash Muslims in lockstep with the NATO intelligence services. So we hear from the genuine version tonight, the Hour of the Times' Bill Cooper, his show from the 28th of June 2001. Clip from that, quite a long clip, but I think you'll agree, pretty shocking that someone can predict 9/11 in that way. And they now say six people per bubble, so that's 6 feet apart, 6 months between lockdowns. 10:30 until 4 p.m. on Monday, they'll be outside Bristol Council House on College Green protesting against the no more than six social meeting rules. It's Stand Up X Bristol. And we hear from one of the people who spoke at the protest, Mark Devlin, a couple of weeks ago. And another protest movement, the 5G movement, has a new member. He's the super wealthy former president of Microsoft Canada. We'll be hearing from him. And finally, a medieval satanic group infiltrating all the monotheistic faiths, hell-bent on privatising the earth so they can buy it up, everything, for their own private property. That's the author of The Dying God we heard from the last couple of weeks. Another clip from him this week, giving his view on the origins of the fake Jewish Kabbalah. He's the author also of Transhumanism. We were hearing James Perloff talking about that. The History of a Dangerous Idea. That's David Livingston. We'll be hearing from him as well. But Martin, first of all, this is the main news of the week. So certainly as far as I'm concerned, is this incredible trial of Julian Assange and the hearings taking place in London with only Craig Murray and his immediate family even allowed in court. And the video feeds to a neighbouring court where other people were watching were switched off by the judge.
Yeah, I mean, what's going on there is in plain sight, but it's hardly being reported in the mainstream media, as you say. But it's an absolute outrage, frankly. I mean, this is the country of Magna Carta, as you will hear in great deal of rhetoric in the US in particular. And here we are, basically prosecuting somebody for telling the truth.
I mean, it's
there's no basis of English law for this at all. It's extraordinary.
It's one of those things that you hear chanted on the streets in protests. The whole world is watching, but this time it really is, isn't it?
Well, we're watching, but of course what they're doing is they're trying to make sure that hardly anybody knows what's going on.
Here in the UK, but other parts of the world are watching. Certainly many people in the US are very closely watching what's going on. Then, although the mainstream media is doing its best to stop them, obviously social media and other methods, this is being shared extensively.
Yeah, I mean, I think that those who are in the know are paying attention. But and it ought to be leading the news, in fact, in the mainstream. But it isn't, because there's definite attempts to control information. That's what the court is trying to do, is to prevent a normal situation where people could go to the court and report on it. So they can't keep people out completely, but they're doing their best.
Are you saying you don't think he's committed any crime?
I don't think he has committed any crime in English law. There's no basis for this at all. And don't forget, he's an Australian citizen who supposedly committed crimes in Britain, and he's being extradited to the United States and being put on trial for treason to the United States. He's not even a United States citizen. Well, and what the US is arguing is that anybody who speaks against the United States is a traitor to the United States, even if they're not a US citizen. And the other thing they're saying is that the freedom of speech, which is guaranteed in the US Constitution, is only guaranteed to US citizens. It's not to anybody. And so that it's a double jeopardy scenario for Assange, because he's not a US citizen, the freedom of speech of the US citizen doesn't apply to him, but also because even though he's not a US citizen, he's subject to US law, even though he's not in the country and he's never been a citizen of the country. Now, I would have thought that should have just been case dismissed straight away by the lowest level magistrate in any magistrate's court in England. But no, apparently not.
Well, one of the most incredible aspects of this case is the way that the US prosecutors have been shifting the sands. You know, the charges have been being changed. And only just last week, a whole new load of charges arrived.
That's because they'd argued that the previous charges were invalid, so they just come up with some new charges, and they're going to carry on doing that because they're basically making the point that the law is what they want it to be. But that's actually outrageous. I mean, the senior lawyers in this country should be up in arms about it. Some of them are. Clive Stafford Smith, who's a lawyer both in the US and Britain, was testifying this week. But the people in charge of the case, Lady Arbuthnot and this woman Baratza, are frankly they're behaving as Nazi lawyers behaved in the 1930s. They're basically scofflaws.
I mean, the obvious headline in a tabloid paper would be Kangaroo Court, wouldn't it? Especially since we've got an Australian.
Exactly. I mean, that's the obvious point, isn't it? I mean, and don't forget, he's been effectively in solitary confinement for nearly a decade. Absolutely outrageous.
So what do you make of this due process being potentially, messed with here? Surely, if you've got a bunch of charges, the legal team have got to be able to deal with those charges, not to have them withdrawn and new charges brought in. This is, surely the judge herself should be saying, well, actually, no, you can't do that. If you want to drop those charges, that means the whole case is going to be dropped and Julian can walk free.
Well, that's because this is becoming a very, very important test case in English law, because they're basically overturning hundreds of years of precedent.
And
a
big test case in US law.
Well, in the US law, you've got the Espionage Act, which was brought in the First World War, basically to silence critics of the First World War. So Eugene Debs, who was the leader of the Socialist Party in the US, was put in prison for 6 years under the Espionage Act. But even Eugene Debs was a US citizen, so you could argue that he could be charged under the Espionage Act because he'd been passed by Congress. Julian Assange is not a US citizen, but the US is arguing, as they've done in various other cases around the world, that their law applies to everybody, even though they don't get a vote in their election. So the courts in New York have agreed that Peter, I'm trying to remember his name now, but basically it doesn't really matter. They basically said that New York law overrides Argentinian law, and therefore that Argentina owes 100% of the debts that it supposedly owes, even though they've already made an agreement with their debtors to reduce.
Well, there's
the debts.
A certain amount of arrogance to this, isn't there? It's not like the US is assuming that a little bit like, that whole situation with the unified command structure, where the US military has got a command structure for every part of the planet. In other words, they dominate, they believe, every part of the planet militarily.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, if you're going to be polite, you'd call them the world's policemen. But they're not the world's policemen, they're the world's gangsters. And ultimately, of course, they're going to have to be put on trial. Not Assange, but the people in charge in the United States of America.
So let's have a listen now to John Shipton, who's Julian Assange's father. And I started off by asking him about the basic origins of Julian, what he was doing as a young man, what got him into doing WikiLeaks, and also about, and it's good to hear, of course, that WikiLeaks is still functioning quite happily without Julian. There are very various people. It's almost like there are plenty of Spartacuses still around to do the job. And the power of WikiLeaks, the actual ability of journalists and publishers, the pen being mightier than the sword, to make enormous great changes in military conflict. So let's have a listen to John Shipton now.
My name is John Shipton. I'm Julian Assange's father. Julian, well, has always been interested in mathematics, and that moved him into computers, as well as social protest. He was involved in the anti-global movement and the World Social Forum for a number of years before moving into WikiLeaks.
What do you think has been the most devastating revelations that Julian has published?
Well, they come in, you know, a lot of different directions. So, for example, one of the cables documents, that's the cables written by the United States soldiers in Iraq, one of them demonstrates that a group of soldiers murdered an entire family, the children, the mother, father, grandfather, uncle, father. They murdered a lot. Horrified at their crime, or horrified that they'd get charged with this crime, they called in the United States Air Force and destroyed the house completely, obliterating the evidence. This cable enraged the Iraqi government, who refused to sign the Status of Forces Agreement, which then required that all of the American troops be withdrawn from Iraq. That's what happened, leaving only those troops that were in the Green Zone, which is the vast embassy in American embassy in Baghdad.
Well, pretty amazing, Martin, there. So you can see the effect that publishing one document, a leaked document, this in this case a cable, can have. The Iraqi government removing the U.S. Army from the whole of Iraq, apart from just within the Green Zone, which, you know, is an enormous big change, because the Iraqis were informed. I suppose that's really what WikiLeaks is doing. It's informing the world, and particularly occupied countries, about what the U.S. is really up to behind the scenes.
Yeah, and you can see why they don't like it, because, you know, they don't go to war to lose, but of course they have lost and they deserve to lose.
Well, what do you make of what he was saying about Julian's early days as an anti-globalisation activist and also taking part in the World Social Forum?
Well, I mean, him and loads of other people, it just shows that he's basically got, you know, socially progressive views, as many people have. But he's taken it to a different level because of his journalistic work.
I can remember being part, I suppose, of these things myself, really. The anti-globalisation protests were big, weren't they, in the 1990s, enormous amount of them. Although they don't seem to be such, it doesn't seem to be such a movement today. Things like Extinction Rebellion are possibly even the opposite. They're saying that we need a global response rather than anti-breaking down national boundaries. They're saying the opposite.
Well, I think it's a different generation, obviously, but a lot of the demands are similar. And of course, the big success of the anti-globalisation movement was to prevent the signing of the Doha. I think it was the Doha round of the World Trade Organization. So they couldn't. I mean, it wasn't just that. What really messed up the plan was that the farmers in India refused to sign up for what Monsanto and others were trying to do, and therefore the whole thing, you know, after decades of discussion, had to be shelved. And as we are learning to our cost, doing trade deals is actually a lot more complicated than it's presented in the mainstream media.
So I also asked John Shipton, who's Julian Assange's father, I asked him about what he made of the media coverage of the case.
I will praise them for their stance lately. They've come aboard. The Washington Post editorial, the New York Times editorial, even the Guardian's editorial, the Times last Sunday, the Times on Sunday, the Mail on Sunday. So they've all come around to realize that if Julian's extradited on and thrown in a dungeon for 175 years, their power, their ability to publish, and their prestige, and consequently their living standards, go down the drain. So they've come around to realise it's their own self-interest, and they're changing their mind and supporting us.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? So his father is, although, of course, there's been some very negative coverage of Julian over the years, or positive coverage. It's been so strange to see the mass media's reaction. But it looks as if, as it's coming down to the wire, the mass media, at least in this country, Martin, is, and he's talking about actually in the US too, is saying, well, actually, this is potentially going to affect every journalist on the planet.
Well, I hope that's the case. And, I can't remember whether there's not even a jury involved in this trial, is there? But I mean, historically, there have been very important trials in Britain where the state has tried to convict people and failed. And they've been the basis of most of our modern civil liberties are a result of these basically, illegal trials which have been overturned. So, let's hope that this can be another one.
11 years of incarceration is a long time, you know, for justice, the wheels of justice turning very, very slowly.
Well, if you think back to it, he went into the Ecuadorian embassy, and because of the psychological warfare against him, there was enormous amounts of fuss. I mean, we had councillors on here from the Liberal Democrats saying, oh, well, he's got to go and stand trial in Sweden. He was never charged with anything in Sweden. And what he said all along was that what this is about is to try and get me extradited to the United States. And loads of people were saying, oh, he's just making this up. He doesn't want to stand trial in Sweden for doing naughty things. And this is all just made up. And but of course, as the police went into the embassy and arrested him with the agreement of Lenin Moreno back in Ecuador, because he was in the pocket of the Americans, and then they immediately put him on trial to go to be extradited.
So it was all affected
the US.
By a switch.
So in other words, he was right all along.
So, but it was all affected by a big switch in politics over in Ecuador.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was Rafael Correa, who was the president, twice re-elected president, under the rules in Ecuador, he couldn't stand for a third term. So Lenin Moreno was one of his followers, and it was decided that he would stand instead of Correa. But Moreno, despite his name Lenin, because he came from a left-wing family, he's basically turned out to be a running dog of imperialism, as they sometimes call them in China. And he's basically they got an IMF loan, and on the back to carry out privatizations and so on in Ecuador, because Correa had been very successful in the same kind of way.
Well, that's a massive
as in Bolivia with Evo Morales. You know, they had a shared
Aren't
agenda.
Aren't these massive international mafia bribes, really?
Well, it's not a bribe so much, because the money that they've got from the IMF in Ecuador is only if they carry out various privatizations and allow...
Yeah, but it looks great, doesn't it? Oh, suddenly companies. We've got loads of money. Even if you're not the person, you're not the president, that has to pay the money back.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, he's basically a traitor to the cause. I mean, he was elected on the same kind of platform as Correa. But he's basically turncoat.
So what the Americans are trying to do here is, number one, is extend their legal jurisdiction into Britain, and number two is to create this, with his 175-year sentence, an enormous chilling effect to make sure that nobody ever thinks like behaving like Julian Assange, that is publishing leaked US secrets, even if it does involve massive violations of human rights and international law and murder, even mass murder. That doesn't seem to matter.
Well, we're on the anniversary of 9/11, and they're quite capable of mass murder, as we all know.
One of the most shocking aspects to the case is the parallel case which has been going on over in Spain about this interesting little company. Can't remember their name, but anyway, do you know them, Martin?
I know who you're talking about. It's basically a private Spanish company, and they were contracted by the CIA to spy on Assange. And what's happened is that the legal...
Oh, it's UC Global.
Yeah, the legal establishment in Spain, because in Spain, as they've got a different system. So Balthazar Garzón, for example, was an independent prosecutor. And, of course, he famously sent Íñigo to prison, who was a socialist interior minister, as a terrorist, because he was involved in organising death squads in the Basque region. So you've got an independent judiciary in Spain.
Well, actually, we've had the Spanish king, the former Spanish king, actually had to go into exile, because otherwise he was going to be prosecuted.
Yeah, well, you've got to remember the history in Spain. None of the Francoists were ever prosecuted for anything they'd done in the years they were in power. But of course, the Balthazar Garçon started to push for some kind of restitution in relation to those things. And you've got an activist judiciary, and what they've been able to do is it was a Spanish company that was involved in this, based in Spain, and they arrested them, and they're being charged with attempt to pervert the course of justice.
Well, one it does see this to a certain extent as almost a competition between the effectiveness of the British and the Spanish judicial system.
Well, that's happened over Pinochet, if you remember, because the Spaniards wanted to extradite him to Spain to stand trial, and Margaret Thatcher famously protected him under her skirts and gave him a memento of the Spanish Armada, because he managed to escape back to Chile and didn't have to stand trial.
Yes, and Andre Vilcek, who's a fairly regular appearer on this show, he was actually over in Chile helping to denazify the country after Pinochet left.
Well, I mean, I don't know what his particular role was. I mean, it's still got a problem in Chile because the army is still effectively...
Well, they had these Nazi encampments. I mean, we're not talking about neo-Nazi. We're talking about they were actually run by people who were directly descended from the SS, people like this, and they were running torture camps and things.
Well, I mean,
usually up at, in farms in the Andes, and they had to get rid of them all after Pinochet.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact is that many people from that era were never prosecuted when they should have been. And, of course, the army is still there in Chile, and you've got a civilian government. But as you know, last year there was massive protests in Chile about the economic situation before COVID or anything else kicked in, and quite a lot of protesters were killed by the police. In fact, a lot more protesters were killed by the police in Chile than have been killed in Belarus. I don't think any have been killed in Belarus, but loads were killed in Chile. There you go.
So let's have a listen to our final clip from John Shipton, Julian Assange's father. And like with James Perloff, I will put up this full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But here he is talking about this incredible hacking right into Julian's life by this UC Global company, which is under trial at the moment in Spain.
The case is ongoing in Spain. They have a different system, as you know, where the judge investigates rather than hears the two sides from the QCs. The judge in Spain investigates. So there's an investigation going on there, very vigorous. The UC Global converted all the cameras and installed new cameras in the embassy, even installing a microphone in the ladies' toilet. I mean, really and truly. Recorded Julian's conferences with lawyers. This is illegal, you know. I mean, it's illegal to spy anyway, but it's an abuse of process. It means that the case cannot go ahead because relationship between the lawyer and the client is protected. Also, they speculated on how to murder Julian by poison, how to kidnap him. Then they made moves to double lock the door so he couldn't walk out. So they became jailers as well as attempting to murder, spying. They followed Julian's lawyers down the street in Brussels. They burgled Julian's lawyer, Balthazar Garçon's offices in Madrid and so on. So also the head of that time of UC Global, the security firm that we're speaking of that was in charge of security at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, he took hard disks once a month over to the United States, handing them over to, well, we presume, the CIA, because at that time the head of the CIA was Mike Pompeo, who in April 2017 declared that the WikiLeaks was going to be ruined and Julian was going to be persecuted to the ends of the earth.
Yeah. So where does the case go from here? Because it seems to be sort of almost every 6 or 8 months that the case has been popping up. But where does it go from this hearing?
All depends. One of the QCs for the prosecution, his spouse, her spouse, sorry, came down with a temperature on today, you know, reported in the morning that he had a temperature. So they suspect COVID. So they're doing a test, and they'll have their results on Monday morning. If it is COVID, I don't know what the court will do. I can't speculate. If it isn't, it'll go on for the next 4 weeks.
And after that, would Julian, do you think Julian may be sent to the US?
I imagine what will happen. I don't think it. I imagine what will happen in normal practice is if the judge says he's free to go, the United States will vigorously appeal and will go to the High Court. If the judge says that he's to be extradited, we will vigorously appeal and will go to the High Court. So that, and that will probably take until May, June.
So it could be that Julian walks out of this court into the street a free man?
Well, you know, I'm not a religious man, but I've taken up to going to the Brompton Oratory and lighting candles. Brompton Oratory being the local Catholic church.
John Chipton, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rick Tony. It's been a pleasure.
So that's John Chipton. You can hear the complete interview. I'll pop it up later tonight on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But that whole UC Global case, Martin, is absolutely incredible. That is going on in Spain right now. It's obvious that these people were, at least this is it is alleged, that they were burgling the lawyers. They were planning to poison Julian Assange, potentially kill Julian Assange. And that they were working absolutely in lockstep with people like Mike Pompeo, who at the same time as they're accused of taking hard disks over to the CIA, Pompeo is trumpeting that he's going to bring down WikiLeaks and Julian Assange forever.
Yeah, well, what's ironic about this is who are the criminals? Who are the criminals here? Is it Julian Assange or is it Mike Pompeo and his acolytes? And of course, if Julian Assange goes free, maybe there should be prosecutions of those involved.
Well, maybe
in
this is maybe
thing.
This is why.
Why should we just sit back and take this?
Maybe this is why the establishment is doing everything it can to make sure he doesn't go free, because of the implications of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, what happens in the US is you do get plea bargaining, so you might get a situation where we let you go as long as you don't pursue this any further. But of course, Balthazar Garzon was forced out of the mainstream judiciary in Spain. He was a senior guy, because he started to ask for investigations into what happened during the Franco era. And, of course, there's still a lot of Francoists in senior positions in Spain, and obviously they're very close to the CIA. I mean, Balthazar Garzón is quite similar to Fernando Imposimato in Italy, because, of course, he was the one who exposed Gladio, and Garzón is a similar character. And I think both Garzón and Imposimato show a way forward out of the mess, which is we don't have to go to war, we've just got to put all these people behind bars, and I don't mean Julian Assange.
So also, just to let you know what John Chipton was telling us there about a possible COVID-19 case amongst the prosecution lawyer's family, apparently it's a false alarm, although I thought that the results of the case...
Oh, that's a relief.
We're going to come on Monday, but somehow...
I'm so happy about that.
There's some other reason for this high temperature. Maybe they've been sitting next to a radiator or something instead of having some kind of disease of COVID-19. But more importantly, Martin, the prosecution are saying in the court today that the prosecution is really part of Donald Trump's war on journalism.
Yeah, well, Trump at one stage was saying that WikiLeaks, because WikiLeaks exposed the Steele dossier and everything to do with that, and also WikiLeaks it was that showed that the DNC National Committee were rigging the election, the primaries in the last election, in president election in the US, against Bernie Sanders. And then they showed that, showed that they were doing that. And B, both Craig Murray, of course, who flew to the US to pick up the material, that it's nothing to do with the Russians at all. And, you know, at one stage, Trump was quite pleased that WikiLeaks had exposed that. But then, of course, he started going on about WikiLeaks. I've never heard of it. Even though, of course, we had loads and loads of things, him saying WikiLeaks have exposed the truth here. WikiLeaks, 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 WikiLeaks. But of course, he's now decided to throw Assange to the wolves because, do you know what? I think Donald's not really a very nice guy. And I don't think I trust him.
The irony of all of this, of course, is that these procedures being taken by UC Global and the CIA, you know, basically stealing lawyers' materials, you know, planning to poison Julian Assange, stealing, hacking into, is actually what's going on is Assange is being prosecuted for what the CIA and these private security people are doing themselves.
Yeah, well, ultimately, as I said earlier, this shows a way forward. Not only are we going to bust Assange out of that prison, hopefully, which will be a very big victory for civil rights in this country, but we're also going to put the people involved on trial. And, you know, Interpol need to be involved. People like Mike Pompeo, who openly boasted that we lie, we cheat, we steal, he's going to regret that.
And he's hopefully. Also saying, of course, he's not going to tolerate China. What exactly does that mean?
What it means is they're trying to break the Chinese system now before they become predominant in the second half of the 21st century, which is basically they're plotting a war, as they've been plotting wars. We've had quite a few of them. This is the biggest one.
Well, the trial is going to resume on Monday. There's a great crowd gathers daily outside the Old Bailey in support of Julian, and that's obviously going to be carrying on. Well, I mean, there'll be a longer and bigger trials. I think the longer trial is going to be taking place, the actual extradition hearing itself, next year. But as part of all of this, there's been quite a lot of other support for Julian Assange. One is a series of lectures and talks and discussions called Imperialism on Trial. Another one of these happened this week with various journalists, some of them wearing face masks and the audience all social distance and that sort of thing. But they are, and one of the things that came up at this was one of the journalists there is Neil Clark, who we've interviewed him. I think it was on the Politics Show or Dialect not so long ago. And Neil is quite famous for doing he's famous, he is in my book anyway, for doing what I consider to be the greatest article on Jeremy Corbyn's, why Jeremy Corbyn lost the December 29 election, which is entitled The Shakespearean Tragedy of Jeremy Corbyn, really looking at the way he treated his enemies better than his friends in his own party. But so Neil Clark at this Imperialism on Trial discussion last week in London brought up the matter of Belarus. Now, Martin, before we hear from Neil, you've been doing these reports on RT about Belarus. Can you just give us in a nutshell whether or not you think that Belarus is going to is this going to carry on? It's become a bit like Venezuela. The mass media constantly, particularly the BBC and the BBC World Service, have been saying, oh, you know, this Lukashenko, even though he was elected president, although they sometimes don't even say that, has got to go. They just repeat this, a little bit like what we had with Assad has got to go, Gaddafi has got to go. Now it's Lukashenko.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to predict the future, but Lukashenko's position is that I won the election fair and square, and you can't just get rid of me because I won. And I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that he lost. He's certainly a bit of a control freak, and the opposition have got legitimate gripes about the way they've been treated. I'm willing to listen to that. But they can't claim that they won the election because they didn't. They got 10% of the vote. They might have got 15% or 20%, but that's not winning the election. It's, Lukashenko's been in power for 26 years because he's quite popular.
Isn't it also the case that Belarus is really the last Eastern European country which was part of the old Soviet Union, the Russian bloc or the Soviet bloc, the Warsaw Pact, that has not started to lean towards the West, towards the EU and towards NATO? You know, we had 5 years ago, we had Ukraine, which switched its allegiance after a coup. But Belarus is one of the last. And also, very importantly, there's this little enclave of Kaliningrad in Poland, which is on
it's not in Poland. Where it's separate from Poland.
Well, it's
contiguous to Poland, but it's not Poland. It's part of Russia.
Yeah. So, but Belarus, in order for Kaliningrad to be able to continue, Belarus has surely got to continue to be a Russian leaning. Otherwise, Kaliningrad would be completely isolated.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are clearly military implications if Belarus was to switch sides. There's no doubt about that. But Kaliningrad is part of Russia, and therefore it's not an independent state. It's literally part of Russia.
It borders onto the Baltic, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, both sides. I mean, if there was,
how did Kaliningrad get there?
It was given to the Russians at the end of World War II. Because there was basically a German population there, and just as in Poland and in Czechoslovakia, that German population was deported back to Germany. Even though they'd lived there for hundreds of years, they were deported back to Germany. You could claim that that's unfair, but that was what was agreed, and the West agreed it, and that's what happened. And of course, then a Russian population was brought in, and it's now virtually 100% Russian. And that's the reality of the situation.
Belarus kind of stretches out from the west of Russia. It's a kind of little bubble, a pocket that reaches almost towards Kaliningrad, but doesn't quite make it there.
Yeah, so in other words, from a military point of view, it's important for both sides, because what they call the Suwalki Gap is that gap. And, of course, it links Belarus, it links Poland and Lithuania, yeah? So, and of course, there's actually disputes between Poland and Lithuania going back to before the war, but the current border is there. So, you know, NATO wants that border to remain their border, as it were. And of course, Belarus is important in a sense for backing Kaliningrad, but in another sense, it's not, because that gap, the Suwalki Gap, is already controlled by NATO. So I suppose from a military point of view, you could see an armoured column could drive from Belarus to Kaliningrad to link it back up. So I don't think anything like that is going to happen. So it's silly to talk in those terms. And most of what's going on is political struggles about the direction of things.
Why is it,
rather
though,
than military?
Do you think that Belarus has been the last country left which is still pro-Soviet and still largely got a kind of rural Soviet economy?
Well, I mean, you've almost answered your own question there. What happened in 91 when the Soviet Union broke up, that Belarus just found itself independent? And Lukashenko didn't come to power immediately, but he did quite soon afterwards. And he used to be a collective farm manager. So that used to be his job. He used to manage a collective farm. So he was basically a middle manager, if you like. And what he said to people is, all the stuff that's going on around us in Russia and in the Baltic states and Poland, we're not going to do any of that. We're going to carry on with our collective farms. We're going to carry on having state-owned industry which services those farms. The big enterprises in Belarus are basically agricultural machinery enterprises and fertilizer enterprises.
Okay, yeah? So it's not worth so much because it's not highly industrialized. Well, it's mainly agricultural.
Well, yeah, and the industry, such as it is related to agriculture. Although the other thing they do actually is they've got quite a bit of military industry, and fascinatingly enough, they actually fix kit both for the Russians and the Ukrainians. Because the Ukrainians are actually rather dependent, you know, they buy a lot of Belarusian stuff. Anyway, the point is, why he's been popular is because he hasn't done what the other countries have done, which is put everybody on out of work, and so on.
Martin, that sentiment is echoed by Neil Clark, who visited and wrote some articles for the New Statesman, or at least an article for the New Statesman on Belarus back in 2010. So let's hear from Neil Clark now, the journalist, speaking earlier this week at the Imperialism on Trial Free Julian Assange meeting in London.
It was so interesting on the Sunday before last, I don't know if anybody looked at the BBC News website, big headlines, Belarus protest. Sweet Belarus, Minsk, wall-to-wall coverage on the BBC and the BBC website. And there was nothing on the BBC of the 35 or 40,000 people who had demonstrated in London against the lockdowns. So I think it's quite strange that the BBC website decided that Belarus was the biggest story for the British public to listen to or to watch. Whereas a big demo in London, literally down the road from the BBC, was not news. the Belarus situation has had enormous coverage in the media, in a lot of so-called liberal papers, and it's quite extraordinary when you consider that Belarus is not on most British people's radar. A lot of people probably wouldn't know where it was. I don't mean that derogatory. It's a fact. A lot of people might be confused where it was. And yet, for the people deciding these stories at the BBC and other places, it is the number one story. You know, 50,000 people in London or 40,000? No, we're not interested in that. Belarus, people are on the streets in Minsk. And Lukashenko has been in power in Belarus since late 1994. I went to Belarus in 2010. And I wrote about Belarus for the New Statesman. I thought it was a very balanced report. And the flack I got for that piece was one of the worst attacks I've had from establishment enforcers. I had actually been to Belarus, and yet I was being attacked for writing what I thought was a fair appraisal of the country and acknowledging that Lukashenko did have, certainly at that time, genuine support from the public because of the economic policies he pursued. There was full employment, there were still factories, and there was still a very good social system. It was a very egalitarian society, and they had avoided a lot of the shock therapy that a lot of the former Soviet bloc countries had. But you couldn't say that. It was a no-no. You can't say anything positive about Belarus. And then it all kind of went quiet a bit, and now it's kind of the main story again. So some saying it's about Russia, and also it's interesting Belarus, one of the two countries in Europe that did not have a lockdown this year over the coronavirus. And Lukashenko claimed that the IMF had said they would give him 10 times as much money if he locked down the country like Italy. So that's another argument why this such emphasis on Belarus now. What's going to be the end game? Would Russia allow a government to come to power there that would threaten it by becoming a NATO member, having NATO troops in Belarus?
I don't think there's any danger that, I mean, don't forget that Lukashenko had fallen out with Putin, because what he was doing was he was trying to steer a middle course. So although it was one of the things that allowed him to have the successful economic policy that he had was getting lots of cheap oil and gas from Russia. But at the same time, he was flirting with the West and saying, what would you give me if I was to come over to your side?
Well, yes,
which of course annoyed the Russians.
This middle course didn't work very well for Jeremy Corbyn, did it?
Well, I mean, they were mixing two things up here.
Well, no, I'm saying that if you've got to actually make a decision as a leader, you can't say, oh, well, actually, I'm going to try and play two powers off against each other.
Well, no, I mean, you've got two different situations with different power dynamics going on. I mean, they're similar in the sense that they're both political situations, but you can't claim that there's a great deal in common between them.
What do you make about this idea of effectively a bribe by the IMF to have a lockdown?
That's what Lukashenko's saying. Yes, I mean that's certainly true. But of course, the problem for Lukashenko is when these protests erupted after the election, the Russians had gone rather cool on him because he'd basically been encouraging the West for some time. Which is a bad mistake on his part. He should have recognised which side his bread was buttered on. And therefore, they were not that unhappy to see him given a bit of a shock. But I don't think, precisely because he's got quite a substantial body of support inside Belarusia, I'm quite sure that the Russians are fairly confident that he can hang on. And what they want to see is a more open situation in Belarusia, but without it necessarily going to NATO. And of course, what they are trying to do indirectly is talk with the opposition, saying, well, if you were given a better chance to, you know, to win elections in Belarusia, what sort of things would you do? And therefore, we're not necessarily hostile to you. But you've got to, I mean, fundamentally, what they've got to recognise, including the Western press and the Western media and Western governments, is they didn't win the election.
Okay, so are we going to see something similar to Venezuela with a bunch of American mercenaries being sent into Belarus to try and kill Lukashenko or create a coup?
Well, I mean, in Ukraine, they definitely did. I mean, they basically assassinated over 80 people.
But is it going to happen? Do you think
they're going to dare to do it? I don't think so, because in Belarusia, you've got a much more homogenous society. in Ukraine is basically a bit of a, you know, is only created in 91. It's an incredibly varied society with very, very big social divisions.
If you were,
Belarus is smaller.
If you were Lukashenko, would you be tempted by Brussels and to sort of?
Well, no, obviously now he's not. I mean, what happened for him is a bit like Gaddafi. He started to say, all right, I want to be a good boy now. What are you going to do to help me? And he was encouraged to think that he was going to be helped. And then they just turn around and whack him in the face when they get close enough. And I think he's learned his lesson, frankly.
Just briefly back to Prime Minister's questions for a couple of, one on the Brexit negotiations and another one on China, Martin, that, apparently we've broken international law now, by ripping up the, agreement with the European Union. This is a bit of a naughty thing to do. Let's hear, obviously the SNP have been particularly angry about that. So they were having a go at Boris Johnson about it at Prime Minister's questions this week.
Ian Blackford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Shortly, this government will publish its internal market proposals. I've seen them. It is nothing short of an attack on Scotland's Parliament and an affront to the people of Scotland. As we've already heard, this legislation breaks international law, but it also breaks domestic law. The Prime Minister and his friends, a parcel of rogues, are creating a rogue state, one where the rule of law does not apply. Why does the Prime Minister think that he and his friends are above the law?
Hear, hear. Well, on the contrary, Mr. Speaker, this UK internal market bill is about protecting jobs, protecting growth, ensuring the fluidity and safety of our UK internal market and prosperity throughout the United Kingdom. And it should be welcomed, I believe, in Scotland, in Northern Ireland, Wales, and throughout the whole country.
He's talking there about the internal market, but it seems as if legally this whole Brexit business seems to be coming apart, both internally in the UK with the other countries, particularly Northern Ireland and Scotland, getting very upset about what the English are doing, but also internationally with Brussels too.
It's very interesting that they've chosen to do this. I suspected he might try and do this once he got his... I mean, we're talking about Boris Johnson and his brain, Dominic Cummings. I think a lot of this is a political decision by Cummings that because they've lost a lot of ground during the COVID crisis for whatever reason, that they can rally the troops by saying, because of course what the deal was that you can have any deal you like for Britain as a whole. You know, you can even have a no deal, but you can't enforce that in Northern Ireland, where the majority clearly voted to remain inside the EU and therefore implicitly inside the single market. And Johnson agreed that in order to get an agreement with the EU, including the Irish. And then he ran an election campaign saying we're going to have a deal based on this. The DUP didn't support him, of course. Now, he can probably get this through Parliament because although there may be some Tory rebels against this, the DUP will probably vote for it because they don't want a border in the Irish Sea. But the agreement that Johnson made with the Irish and the EU was that there would be a border in the Irish Sea.
Well, the Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin has said there are now justifiable doubts as to whether the UK actually wants to conclude negotiations at all.
Well, I think that's pretty obvious from the get-go. What they want is a no-deal Brexit or near as damn it. And, of course, that would, in a sense, that would have been acceptable to the EU as long as Northern Ireland isn't included in it. But, of course, he's gone the extra mile now to get his own right wing going, and the loyalists, of course, as that we're not going to have it. We're going to have a hard border in Ireland, which,
Jacob
of course, this is what it's all about.
Martin, the Jacob Rees-Moggs of this world will be saying, well, actually, this is really what the Brussels negotiators want. They don't actually really want an agreement either. And so we are going to have to be the ones that... I suppose tear up the withdrawal agreement because that we can't come to an agreement with them.
Well, the withdrawal agreement, the aspects of the withdrawal agreement that are causing all the bother are related to Ireland. And of course that was the sticking point. What Theresa May had negotiated with the EU is that there wouldn't be a border in the Irish Sea or a border in Northern Ireland because there would basically be the same rules on both sides of the Irish Sea. Effectively a soft Brexit. Now, that's not satisfactory to the right wing of the Tory party. They want a hard Brexit. And the EU position, the Irish position, is okay, you can have that, but you can't have it in Ireland because we don't want it. And it's all a question of sovereignty for Ireland, never mind sovereignty for the UK. But what Cummings and Johnson are doing is going for broke here. They're trying to create as much conflict as possible so that they can then pretend that when we get to a no deal, as we're going to do at the end of December, it's somehow the Irish fault. And, but of course, the Irish don't see it that way.
Well, we talked earlier, didn't we, about COVID ramping up the tensions with China. Chinese warplanes this week have entered Taiwan. In fact, today, Chinese warplanes have entered Taiwan airspace for a second day. Now, this is a running sore, isn't it? And one does look back at the British Empire and things like Kashmir. It's almost as if these big empires over the years have left these situations like the Taiwan situation, which is independent of China, even though China claims it as part of itself, as running sores. And there's more and more attention on Taiwan now because the US is ramping up its trade war with China. But what do you make of these Chinese warplanes now flying over Taiwan?
Well, I mean, all of these conflicts are a product of history, whether in Ireland, Taiwan, Kashmir, Palestine. And of course, many of them are a result of the British Empire.
The Taiwanese, by the way, have been doing missile tests off the island's coast. So yeah. That seems to be the reason why China is saying, well, if you're going to be testing missiles off the coast, we're going to be flying our aeroplanes around having a good old look at you. Don't forget,
I think the Royal Navy and the US are happily steaming into what the Chinese regard as their own territorial waters. And the Chinese have got quite a big navy. They could be carrying out exercises off the coast of in the channel, as long as they do it, what would happen if they did? I mean, of course, the other thing that happened, you mentioned last week about the B-52s at Fairford, they flew over the whole of Europe and then flew right along the front line in Ukraine, round Crimea, and then flew all the way back again. Basically, coat trailing is what they used to call that in Ireland, bit of coat trailing. And of course, they're daring the Russians to shoot at them. Isn't that wonderful?
So you heard it here first, folks. That's what those aircraft were. I mean, it was.
Well, you didn't hear it. I mean, I got it from somewhere else.
Well,
I mean,
yes, but we
I didn't get any inside information.
We were flagging this up a couple of weeks ago. Look at these B-52s landing at Fairford. Could they be? Actually, we were talking, I think, about Belarus, weren't we?
Yep.
And that clearly seems to be the direction that they were heading in over that direction to sort of annoy the Russians.
Yeah, but there's been various run-ins between aircraft in the Baltic and in Black Sea.
But the point is, this makes Gloucestershire a nuclear target. Why do we want these B-52s based here in Gloucestershire? We don't.
Well, you and I don't, but the government's position is we want our sovereignty, which means that when the Americans decide to go to war with Iran or assassinate Iran's top general, we're ready to go woof, we're his master's voice. That's sovereignty Tory style.
Okay, so anyway, back to China and Prime Minister's questions. China came up this week.
One might talk.
Mr. Speaker, they herd them onto trains, they shave their heads, they abort their babies. A genocide of the Uyghur people by the Chinese government is taking place before our eyes. It is easy to criticise the next world superpower, harder to take action. What action is the Prime Minister going to take to stop the ethnic cleansing of the Uyghur people in Xinjiang? And when will he lead organisation of an international tribunal? Because this time, no country can say that they didn't know.
Well, Mr. Speaker, she is entirely right to draw attention to the plight of the Uyghurs, as both I and the Foreign Secretary have done ourselves, and we raise these concerns directly with the Chinese authorities, and will continue to do so in the G20, at the UN, and in every other context.
When is there going to be an international tribunal to put the British politicians on trial who have caused the biggest humanitarian catastrophe on the planet today in Yemen? British military personnel are currently in Saudi Arabia helping murder children, the ethnic cleansing of the Houthis, and it's probably far more people are being killed in Yemen than are being killed in...
Does that make the persecution of the Uyghurs in China okay?
No, it doesn't. And in actual fact, if Britain wanted to do something about the Uyghurs in China, they should show that they could care about human rights in Yemen, and then they'd have a case to make. In actual fact, they've got no case to make, because they are involved in ethnic cleansing all over the world, not just the Chinese. But it's funny that the Chinese are the ones we want to talk about, where we can't do anything about it. Where we can do something about it, we don't want to talk about it at all.
It does sound to me like you're kind of just making excuses for Martin.
Let's discuss what the problems are. The Uyghurs have got thousands...
The Uyghurs, yeah.
Uyghurs have got thousands of their young men fighting in Syria. They're not from Syria, but they're part of...
So they basically have a security problem, and that's why they're doing this.
Yes.
So Syria, next door to that, is what? Israel. Israeli airstrikes, apparently, over the last day or so, have been targeting Aleppo. So the Israelis are shooting... they're overflying Syria. They are bombing Aleppo, but they're not admitting it. So this is news coming out of Syria and the Middle East generally, but the Israelis don't want to admit that they're actually overflying Syria and carrying on bombing.
Well, I'd be interested to know what their targets are in Aleppo. I think Aleppo is now under the control of the Syrian government, isn't it? So they're attacking Syrian government army targets.
Just read out this from antiwar.com. Israeli attacks on targets across Syria. More on Thursday. Details of the damage inflicting are unclear, with Syrian state media claiming the military have intercepted a lot of missiles, and initially there was no damage or casualties. What was being attacked is not clear, though state media said the T4 airbase was where one burst of missiles was headed. They were said to have been fired from Syrian airspace near Al Tanf, a US-controlled base. They're after the airports, basically, the airfields.
Yeah. So, I mean, what tends to happen in the run-up to World War One, everybody was accusing everybody else of oppressing people. And as we know in warfare, the first casualty is truth. Everybody is pushing their own agenda about what they think should be happening and telling how terrible the other side are, and of course ignoring their own egregious misbehaviour, which we don't want to talk about.
Well, we're going to have a little look at, as it's the 11th of September today, the 19th anniversary of the September the 11th attacks. Martin, you got involved quite early, as I did, with the 9/11 truth movement here in the UK. And one of the chairs of that was a chap called Justin Walker. Another one was Ian R. Crane, who has literally very recently just recovered from a serious life-threatening disease of some sort. But anyway, I thought we'd have a chat to Justin Walker this week and see what he made of 9/11, COVID and climate change. He's also very much focused on the economic problems. So it's before we hear from Justin, I mean, in what way are these connected, do you think? We've already talked about the massive bailouts caused by the lockdowns under cover of the lockdowns. But does this link up, do you think, to the Great Reset? And does it link up to 9/11 too or not?
Well, I think everything's connected to everything else. But on the other hand, the way in which it's connected, I think there's legitimate disagreement about how all these things fit together. So before I make any comment, let's hear what Justin's got to say.
We know that we've had the fake science, the bad science of man-made global warming pumped into the schoolrooms and everywhere you look. Big business now, and the banking, the Bank for International Settlements, the Bank of England, all these big financial institutions are all talking about climate change and getting CO2, and you know, any companies now that don't go along with man-made global warming will find themselves penalized and put out of business. I mean, you know, everywhere you look now, it is the big green deal, the new green deal. So what we now have is the new green deal coupled with this thing called the Great Reset, which a guy called Schwartz, what's his first name? I can't think of his first name. But anyway, the guy who created the World Economic Forum at Davos, he came up with a thing called the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and that is taking humanity towards transhumanism and centralized living cells which run by 5G. I mean, the whole thing is a nightmare. it is effectively fascism. It is basically the world being run by technology, and you will do as you're told. You'll be microchipped. You'll be basically attached in weird ways to the internet of all things. And anyway, it's just a nightmare scenario that's building. But they are going for this great reset. And to do that, they had to trash the global economy. They had to cause such a jolt in the economy that they could justify triggering this great reset. So this sudden pandemic has come along, which is now being used to reset the economy. And, well, as far as I'm concerned, it is 9/11. It's another form of 9/11 because everyone's, well, not everyone, far from it, but a large number of people still believe the official accounts of what the governments are saying, that we're being blitzed by this dreadful pandemic. The winter of 2017-2018 in this country. And you can go to the Office of National Statistics to get the facts. During the winter of 2017-2018, excess deaths, this country experienced 50,100. 50,100 excess deaths. Now, I believe the current death toll for the whole of coronavirus in this country is roughly around about 43,000. They had to revise it downwards, but it is well below the 50,000 we lost during the winter of 2017-2018.
So that's Justin Walker there speaking to me earlier this week, Martin. Again, with Justin, I'll put the longer version of that interview up with him on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But he's definitely pointing to this great reset. Everyone has got to keep their eyes fixed on it because he believes that that there is a whole new kind of deeper, worse level of international financial architecture coming along, and that the COVID has been used as an excuse to bring this in. That's effectively what he's saying.
Well, I tend to agree. I mean, it's quite clear that we've reached an inflection point in world affairs. I mean, the situation we're in now is by far the most serious since World War II. But I don't necessarily agree with every aspect of the of his analysis. People disagree about things. We don't always necessarily see eye to eye.
Also, I thought it'd be useful. I mean, we've had we had a poem last week, and we've got this Stand Up Bristol protest going on between 10:30 and 4 p.m. On Monday outside the council house on College Green against the new rules about no more than six people being able to socialise together, basically saying that there's no real justification for it at all. And there are, by the way, court cases chugging along which are challenging these, judicial reviews, that sort of thing. I thought we'd have a listen to Mark Devlin, who was one of the speakers at the Stand Up Bristol protest on the 30th of August, which I was also speaking at, and we heard the poem from last week. Mark Devlin hails from Oxford. He's got basically, I suppose, an ICist, you would call him, but he's got also, he had quite a lot to say about 9/11 too. I find it fascinating that there are people looking at this as the sort of domestic version of 9/11, whereas 9/11 was affecting foreign policy and the Foreign Office. This is almost like the Home Office version being carried out on us now. So here's Mark Devlin. Here he is, and his power cut out to his microphone, and so he picked up a megaphone and carried on his speech.
Can you still hear me?
Yes!
Okay. So we're the ones that are getting painted as the dangerous ones that are affecting everyone's safety because we're not observing these measures. But look at how everything's been twisted and inverted. We are the ones who are standing up for the rights and freedoms, not just for ourselves, but for everybody else.
Yes.
And yet we're being framed as dangerous people who are helping to spread the virus. Meanwhile, the vast majority of the population are walking around in their masks,
yes,
being fearful the way they've been instructed to be, thinking this makes them good people, thinking they're doing the right thing. There's no virtue in being a slave.
Yes.
There's no virtue in kowtowing to tyrannical governmental regimes. And that's how everything gets inverted, because people don't realise these are the mind games that are played on them by the treacherous mainstream media? And why do people even still believe a word that comes out of the mouth of these mainstream media or lamestream media operations when they've got a proven track record of lying to us time and time again? How short people's memories are. Wasn't it the very mainstream media that's telling us to be afraid of this virus that told us about weapons of mass destruction coming out of Iraq, which turned out to be a lie?
Didn't they tell us that?
Yes.
Wasn't it the same mainstream media that told us Osama bin Laden had been taken out by a crack team of Navy SEALs on the 1st of May, interesting date, 2011, 10 years after he actually died at the end of 2001, as reported by a whole load of Middle Eastern newspapers at the time? The same mainstream media that told us Iraqi soldiers in the first Gulf War had been going into hospitals and taking babies out of incubators and leaving them on the floor to die, which later turned out to be a complete concoction, a complete lie, and the woman who told the story was the daughter of an American ambassador to one of these countries. The same mainstream media, the same BBC, where they heard their reporter Jane Stanley standing in front of World Trade Center 7 telling us it had collapsed some 20 odd minutes before it actually had, because they jumped ahead a bit in the script. It's the same mainstream media that's giving you all these inflated false death and infection figures for COVID-19, and yet people are still believing them even after all these lies. So I equate it to, if you had a confidence trickster that knocked on your front door and asked you to invest £100 in this new amazing scheme that he's got, and you can get rich really quick, and you take him at his word and you say, oh, okay, mate, here's £100, and he clears off with your £100 and you never hear from him again. If that same guy, 1 year later, comes knocking on your door and says, I've got a great investment scheme, all you've got to do is give me £100. Are you going to go, okay, here's £100? Or are you going to go, you've been here before, you're a con artist, you're a thief, get gone, I'm not listening to a word you say. And yet when you equate that situation to the media, people are prepared to give them second chances again and again and again. And they also believe all the lies that come out of the mouths of these government ministers. And believe it or not, there are still people who are actually of the belief that the government cares about us, and all this virus narrative is about keeping us safe because they care. You know, Matt Hancock is just less of the ham. He's a lovely guy and he just cares about us and wants to keep us all safe. You know, you can see it in his eyes. So all these traitors in the mainstream media, they belong in jail, along with Boris Johnson, along with Matt Hancock, left of the hand, Chris Whitty, Neil Ferguson, Bill Gates, Anthony Fauci, and the rest of these traitors to humanity.
So that's Mark Devlin there speaking in Castle Park here in Bristol at the Stand Up Bristol protest. You know, he is going into all sorts of things there, Martin, but one of these things I think, you know, keeps going, it's unstoppable, is the basic facts around 9/11 are a massive lie that was told to the public through the mainstream press. Jane Stanley, you know, this whole idea that the BBC can, or through BBC World, be telling you that a building, building 7, has collapsed half an hour or so before it actually did. It's clear that they're operating to a script. This is not them reporting on events. There is a script that they're following. So really, this is theatre. It's not news.
Well, what happened in that particular case is, I believe that the journalist was told that the building was going to collapse, and therefore she said, okay, I'll be, you know, the building has collapsed. I don't think the BBC were in on it as such. I think that they were basically not doing
job. They're getting, I believe it was from Reuters that the release came.
Exactly. So in other words, everybody's repeating hearsay without checking it. And of course, in her particular case, it was particularly poignant because the building she claimed had collapsed was actually behind her in the shot. And it certainly hadn't
collapsed. So it does suggest that the whole thing was deliberate and following a script on that.
Well, no, yeah, but I don't think the BBC journalist was in on it. I think that's an exaggeration.
No, but this is the problem, is that the journalists are not questioning what they're seeing.
No, indeed.
So she turns around and points to the, she actually steps back and points to the skyline saying Building 7 has collapsed. And as she puts her hand up pointing to the skyline, there is Building 7.
Well,
it hasn't collapsed.
I don't think she even pointed to it. I think she, in actual fact, she said it had collapsed, but she didn't even realise what she was
saying. Well, she just stepped aside so you could see the skyline. And as she stepped aside so you could see the skyline, there's Building 7 that she's said has collapsed.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the way, if you're trying to understand how these psychological or warfare operations operate, it isn't just that everybody's in on what's going on.
Well, we're not saying
a small number of people are in on what's going on.
She's being told.
Lots of other people are just going along with what they're told.
She's been told what to say, and she's just repeating it without questioning.
That's right. And of course, for 9/11 Truth on their website have now got a very good presentation of all the other journalists who were there, 36 of them that day, all saying there have been explosions in the buildings. And Donald Trump, the President of the United States, made a statement, which you can find on YouTube, where he said, I've got news for you, those buildings have been bombed. They've been bombed because they don't collapse like that. And that's what he said. And I'd like to say that to everybody thinking about voting for Donald Trump in the election that's coming up in November, that's what he said on the day. And he was right about that. The buildings were bombed. And they weren't bombed by Al-Qaeda, were they? They were bombed by the US security forces, and somebody has to pay. And it's got to, that's where we're going. And of course,
well, it may be private interests in the US, mightn't it?
No, because nanothermite was found in the dust by Nils Harrit and Steve Jones, who are chemists, and it was all reviewed through all of the chemistry journals. In other words, who's got nanothermite? The only people with nanothermite are the US security forces. They killed those people so that they could set off for a war in a foreign country, which is every bit as bad as anything done by the Nazis.
Well, this doesn't actually benefit the US. Surely it only benefits Israel.
Well, the Israelis and the US ruling class are embedded with each other. Jared Kushner, who's married to Ivanka Trump, is a orthodox.
And what about the Brits?
The Brits are in the game as well, no doubt about it. And the question this is what we're up against. At the same time, there's a problem because of all the lies that have been told. People wake up and they start questioning what's going on. But then, of course, they can be equally easily bamboozled because they...
Well, you end up, don't you, in the world of David Icke, where everything is a lie.
Indeed. And therefore, but the problem with all of this, as the philosopher Wittgenstein pointed out years ago, is that the problem is that everybody thinks that they and they alone have seen through the lies. So he used to say the Marxists think it's all about money. The Freudians think it's all about sex. He seems to think it's all about the media. And in actual fact, the way in which these things are actually done is very, very complex and very cleverly thought through.
Well, what we try and do is we try and go through all of those various different questions and answer each one in turn. And I would always at this point recommend a book by David Southwell, which is called Secrets and Lies, where every page has got a different, what you might just call a conspiracy of some sort, and he picks it apart and he gives you all the information that you need to figure out whether it's true or not. And that is what we try and do on this program every week.
Well, I think that's right, Tony, because the danger is that having seen through the mainstream lies, people then are easily basically fooled by non-mainstream lies. And in actual fact, getting to the bottom of things requires a great deal of effort.
Well,
it's not that easy.
Well, that's what we try and do. But of course, this is part of a psychological operation. And we see the mainstream press doing this all the time, is to mix up the truth and the lies. The idea being to just kind of bamboozle and confuse the viewers and the listeners.
Well, you mentioned earlier, and I think we're going to hear from William Cooper. I mean, you've got, Alex Jones, who was very much in favour of the idea that 9/11 was an inside job, and he was even congratulated to helping to get Donald Trump elected, because Donald Trump seemed to think that 9/11 was an inside job. But of course, Alex Jones fundamentally, it looks like, is working for Israeli intelligence, and so therefore all the people that went along with the 9/11 truth stuff, he then starts feeding them a lot of
nonsense. Yeah, it's funny that InfoWars popped up in 1999, just before the demise of Bill Cooper. So anyway, let's hear now from the genuine version that Alex Jones is like a doppelganger of Bill Cooper, former Naval Intelligence Officer. And this is his program that he put out on June the 28th, 2001. This isn't the whole thing. This is just a 7-minute extract from it, where he talks very clearly about the prediction that Osama bin Laden is going to be blamed for a massive attack on the United States. And that was this is 2 months before the attack took place, just over 2 months.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening once again to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, have you been paying attention to the news lately? After the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, we were bombarded with anti-patriot, anti-militia, anti-constitutionalists. That's people who believe in the Constitution for the United States of America. Anti-American propaganda. And then when the execution of Timothy McVeigh occurred, once again, prior to and immediately following, the same thing occurred again. And this word extremist was used over and 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 over again. And now we're being bombarded with messages that Osama bin Laden is planning to attack the United States of America and Israel. And I'm telling you, be prepared for a major attack. But it won't be Osama bin Laden. It will be those behind the New World Order who once again want to take the guns and the freedom away from the American people, because we're the only ones left in the world who can oppose the destruction of freedom in the world and the implementation of a one-world totalitarian government, and that is the goal. Now, how stupid can you be to believe that Timothy McVeigh was the mastermind of the destruction of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, and just he and Terry Nichols, who appears to be somewhat of a fool, plotted, planned, obtained all the different materials, put together a bomb of such force that it brought down what we call in the military a hard target, a target held up by steel reinforced concrete columns, and he had no help. No help. The feds never looked for John Doe number 2. In fact, they ordered their agents not to look for him and sent out instructions to all police departments and agencies that there was no John Doe number 2, that Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols were the only participants in the bombing, and not to look for anybody else. How about that? They're doing the same thing today with Osama bin Laden, and that's where I've been getting at. Can you believe what you have been seeing on CNN today, ladies and gentlemen? Can you believe it? Supposedly, a CNN reporter found Osama bin Laden, took a television camera crew with him, went into Osama bin Laden's house, interviewed him and his top leadership, his top lieutenants and colonels and generals in their hideout. This is a CNN reporter with a camera crew. And he came out and told everybody, within 3 weeks, Osama bin Laden is going to attack the United States and Israel. Now, don't you think that's kind of strange, folks? You see, because the largest intelligence apparatus in the world, with the biggest budget in the history of the world, has been looking for Osama bin Laden for years and years and years, and can't find him. The FBI also, under the leadership of Louis Freeh, has been looking for Osama bin Laden for years and years and years and years and years and many years, and can't find him. Some doofus, jerk-off reporter with a camera crew waltzes right into his hideout and interviews him. And you know what his budget is? Zip, zilch, nothing. Now, that tells us two things. Either everyone in the intelligence community and all of the intelligence agencies of the United States government are blithering idiots and incompetent fools, including the entire apparatus of the FBI and all of their personnel, or they're lying to us. They're not looking for him at all. And the second is the truth. You see, the CIA created Osama bin Laden. They recruited him. They trained him. They found his leadership. They brought them all together. They showed them how to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And when that was over, they still continued to fund him and train him, and they're now using him to help bring about world government by making him the big boogeyman because they can't use Saddam Hussein anymore. Did you ever hear of Osama bin Laden before you heard of Saddam Hussein? When did you start hearing of Osama bin Laden? It was after Saddam Hussein and Iraq were supposedly neutralized in the Gulf War, because they needed a new boogeyman. But they're not looking for Osama bin Laden, because I'm telling you right now, if I were the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, within 2 weeks I would have him dead or in custody without fail, without fail. If I had those assets and that money, he would be mine. I would own his terrorist ass within 2 weeks without fail. A reporter from CNN and his little camera crew got in to Osama bin Laden's secret hideout and conducted an interview. If you don't believe me, tune into CNN. They're probably running it right now as I'm speaking. And if you believe it, you are one of the stupidest jerks that ever lived on the face of this earth. And whatever is going to happen that they're going to blame on Osama bin Laden, don't you even believe it. Another social engineering project to change the minds and the attitudes and the beliefs of the people of the world, and especially the United States, to bring about one world socialist totalitarian government.
So that's William Cooper speaking on the 28th of June, 2001. He did get something wrong, Martin. He said that the CNN and the rest of them were saying that there might be some sort of attack. They were worried in mid-July. It didn't happen in mid-July. It happened about another month after that, didn't it? But I think it's pretty amazing. His analysis there is making it absolutely clear that Osama bin Laden is being prepared, pre-prepared, in public, on the television, so that everyone knows who he is when 9/11 happens.
Yeah, I mean, basically, he's obviously got some inside knowledge because he's an ex-naval intelligence guy. But
he's making a very basic point, isn't he? He's saying, well, hang on a minute. If this guy is really being sought by the CIA, then there's no way that a CNN camera crew can find him, but the CIA can't. It's a basic bit of logic he's pointing out, which actually tears the whole lie of that CNN story and the CIA story to pieces.
Yeah, and you know, he obviously didn't have inside knowledge of what the targets was going to be. But, I mean, basically, he's pretty correct. I mean, the official story is that Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden used to work for the CIA, MI6, and they were armed and trained and directed with Saudi money to fight the Red Army in Afghanistan. But glory be, they changed direction. They suddenly bit the hand that fed them and started bombing in Kenya and elsewhere and so on. And of course, Robert Fisk, who's a much more credible journalist in my view than William Cooper, he interviewed Osama bin Laden, and he was basically told that, you know, that he'd changed his mind, and the reason Osama bin Laden had, you know, in other words, we were being prepared in advance for Osama bin Laden to be, you know, Emmanuel Bronstein, as in 1984.
Do you want to do a prediction to say what you think is going to happen in the future? I mean, particularly one of the things we know that's coming on the horizon at the moment is a bit of educated guesswork, really, about this global reset, because it does seem as if there's got to be some kind of economic collapse of some kind for them to justify bringing in a kind of basic complete replacement for the IMF.
Well, I mean, this is a bigger question. The mainstream are talking about the Green New Deal and the Great Reset. Now, in actual fact, even if there wasn't any conspiracies going on, capitalism is running up against the wall. It's about to collapse. They know that, and they're preparing for the follow-on. And, of course, the follow-on isn't going to be totalitarian world socialist government. It's going to be World War III, which is going to pit the Russian military and the Chinese military against the Western and Israeli military.
Isn't the whole point of that World War III to create such trauma that the world agrees that we need some kind of world government?
Well, what may well happen if the right people win is we will have some kind of world government, but most likely, more likely than anything else, is we're just going to see a collapse of civilization. There isn't going to be a great reset. There's going to be a great collapse.
Well, the spark for all of this does certainly seem to be, potentially anyway, in the Middle East between Iran and Israel. I wonder, you know, the false flag seems to be the favoured method, but I wonder, do you think it's feasible to have something like, I mean, we've seen these chemical weapons attacks which haven't been successful, to have something so audacious as a nuclear false flag? We were talking last week, weren't we, about missing nuclear weapons, stuff being sold on the black market, nuclear weapons on the black market.
Well, you could, the could be some kind of nuclear attack, either false flag or direct. That's definitely possible. People have got to realise we came very, very close to nuclear war in 1983. The buttons were just about to be pressed, and then they weren't. And of course, this is the point about the what's happened with the getting out the INF treaty and so on, is that both the Russians and the Chinese are very aware that a first strike is being planned against
them. But with a totalitarian type of a system happening to then come in, obviously under wartime, even worse than what we've happened to deal with under COVID, and you've pointed this out yourself, that 5G could actually be something which enables effective kind of drone policing to go on within our cities. Now, that's another aspect to all of this which hasn't really been touched on, the fact that 5G is actually a military system as well as a nice telecom system for downloading things on your phone or whatever. It's also a military system, as Thierry Mason and others have pointed out.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically, all of these technologies are dual use. They've got some civilian uses, and they've also got military uses.
Anyway,
which is why the Chinese have been developing them, and why the Americans are starting to panic, because the Chinese seem to be ahead.
Anyway, before we have a listen to David Livingstone, the final item, I thought it'd be interesting to listen to the retired president of Microsoft Canada, Frank Clegg, because he's come out as a anti-5G person, and he should know, having been at the centre, it might be that the Canadian anti-5G campaign is going to get a bit of a financial boost with people like him on side. And what irritates me more than anything else, Martin, is that the mainstream press, we don't hear anything from Frank Clegg, the retired president of Microsoft, about why 5G might be dangerous. All we get is that, oh, all these nutty anti-5G campaigners, they're all David Icke supporters, or that they're basically insane. There is a very, very definite argument, for example, against the vaccines. You can have a reasoned argument against those, but you can also have a very reasoned argument against 5G, but that's being denied by the mass media.
Well, what goes on, of course, is you've got some people like Piers Corbyn who think 5G has got something to do with COVID, and you've got other people who want to mix in things about you know, the problem is that, some, as I said earlier, people, if you're going to analyze these things, you've got to have a skeptical mind. And the problem is that people criticize some things, but then they start mixing all up. It's like putting it in a blender and going...
Let me put my journalistic hat on for a minute, which I do occasionally, believe it or not. And that is, we really ought to say, for example, with the COVID-19, let's have a discussion and debate between Bill Gates and Andrew Wakefield, between two opposed experts in the field. And that's, to me, what journalism should be about. So anyway, so I'm going to let you listen now to someone you will not have heard of at all, I would imagine.
No, I heard him last week on the
BBC.
Frank Clegg,
who's he's a technological expert. He's the former president of Microsoft Canada, and here he is warning us about 5G.
Hello, my name is Frank Clegg, and I've spent over 40 years in the technology sector. My most recent position is a president of Microsoft Canada. In my career, I've seen the tremendous benefit that technology can provide. I've also seen the potential harm if technology is not implemented correctly. 5G technology has not been tested. I am not aware of a single study that shows that 5G technology is safe. 5G, as in all other wireless technology, gives off radio frequency radiation, which is absorbed in the human body and accumulates in the human body. One segment of 5G technology are millimeter waves. Millimeter waves are used by the US and Israeli government in their active denial systems, which are used for crowd control. And what they do is they provide a very painful reaction in the skin organs of the body. We have no idea what the impacts will be to human health if that kind of millimeter wave technology is used and we are exposed to it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There are significant proven health effects from wireless technology and wireless devices. These include insomnia, headaches, fatigue, heart palpitations, all caused by exposure to wireless devices and the radiation from them. More serious symptoms and conditions include heart arrhythmia, infertility, tinnitus, numbness or tingling in the extremities, diabetes, cancer, and permanent DNA damage. Mental health is also impacted, with increased anxiety, depression, rises in ADHD and autism, mood swings, and emotional instability. In fact, all of these health factors and conditions have risen exponentially over the last 30 years, and hundreds of studies that show proof of biological harm from wireless devices. Most recently, in 2018, the National Institute of Health's National Toxicology Program released the findings of a 14-year, $25 million study that showed clear evidence of harm in terms of cancer and permanent DNA damage. This study, several months later, was verified by the prestigious Ramazzini Institute out of Italy, which found the same results. Now, you may ask how a product that has this potential harm could ever be released to the market and to the public for public use. Well, the way the process works is the FCC regulates all wireless devices and products associated with them. Unfortunately, the FCC is made up of previous telecom executives, lawyers, and engineers. It does not have any scientists or doctors that you would expect to be involved with the regulation of potentially harmful products. In fact, the FCC guidelines are 20 years out of date without any major significant improvement.
So that's Frank Clegg, former, retired president of Microsoft Canada. I mean, Martin, he's saying there that we've got enormous amounts of proof of biological harm, and yet people who are campaigning to stop 5G masks and things like that are basically called lunatics. So we are being gaslighted by both the government, the industry, and by the mainstream press on 5G.
Well, I mean, I hear with interest what he has to say, because he's got the technological background to make a serious case. I'm open-minded about this. I think it's quite likely that what tends to happen in any case, even with relatively harmless technologies, is that if there's money to be made or there's a military advantage to be achieved, then they're going to go ahead with it. The same thing was true of radar during World War II. They knew at the time that people who were operating radar stations were going to be very seriously affected by it. But at the time, the issue was defeating Hitler, and so they didn't bother to tell anybody.
Isn't this really about the regulation? I mean, he's talking there about the FCC, but in Europe and other parts of the world is this organisation called ICNRP, I-C-N-R-P, which is there was a report by two MEPs a couple of months ago that said, well, actually, these are basically just industry people on this body, so they're regulating themselves. There is no regulation. Let's just be frank about it. There isn't any proper regulation at all.
Well, it's what it is what's called regulatory capture in economics textbooks. But of course, I'm trying to stress the military applications of this. This is one of the reasons why they're going to cut corners. The same reason why they injected loads of flu virus into soldiers in Kansas before they set off to go and fight on the Western Front in World War One. They weren't wasting time carrying out proper tests to try and see whether it was safe or not. They were cutting corners for military reasons. And I think that you've probably got the same sort of thing going on. If the Chinese are getting ahead on 5G, as they seem to be, for both commercial and military reasons, then you have got to compete with them and develop the same sort of technology.
So if you're bringing in a military technology which hasn't been tested and there's proof that it's biologically harmful, this can only be called evil, really.
Well, the problem is, if somebody else is doing it, and your enemies, if you don't do it, they're going to beat you in the coming war. And therefore, the pressure on everybody is to cut corners and with all the consequences that we know. I mean, in actual fact, the military-industrial complexes of the world, plus the commercial desires of the backers of these kinds of new technology, override human welfare every time,
well,
don't they?
Believe it or not, there was a time when the mainstream media took evil seriously, and here is a clip we're going to hear now from ABC, the Australian program 60 Minutes, from a film called The Servants of Satan, which was removed from my YouTube channel by YouTube a few weeks ago. And here is just the opening lines of that documentary, where they're looking at satanic ritual abuse.
Friends of family and strangers and our family used to rape me, make me abort the babies I had.
It would be hard to imagine more misery and suffering than what Teresa says she's had to endure.
And us kids would be made to do things with the adults and the animals, and then a sacrifice would happen.
The sacrifice? Were these animal sacrifices?
Animals and people.
On what scale do you think this was happening?
Enormous. Far beyond what we've ever heard of here before.
Teresa's mother, Bridget.
You're talking about mass murder?
Yes. On a scale that this country's never heard of before.
Like the old people's homes now. I mean, there's a...
For the first time, Teresa is learning what it's like to live with love instead of fear.
Pretty though.
In this quiet English village, with the help of her mother, she's slowly repairing her broken life. Teresa is now 15, but at the age of 2, she was left in the care of this woman, the grandma she called Nan. And that, she says, is when her torment started.
Who was the leader? Who was the boss of the gang, of the cult?
At home, it was my Nan.
So that's a clip from the ABC Australian documentary 60 Minutes, in the opening clip, actually. The title of the documentary was Servants of Satan. That was released in 1989, a documentary about satanic ritual abuse recorded here in the UK. Martin, often you find that countries find it very difficult, their own media, to actually do documentaries about difficult things going on in their own countries. So I guess that's why the Australians came to Britain to do it. You know, that would have been a very difficult film to make in Britain. We had a similar situation with the Conspiracy of Silence documentary, which was made for US TV actually by Yorkshire Television. So to actually make a film about this kind of evil going on in your own country is almost impossible. You've got to go and at the very least make it in another country. But now, you know, this is, we're talking about now 30 years on from when that documentary was made. It's almost impossible to do at all.
Well, I mean, the allegations are being made all the time, and the mainstream media, as we know, is dominated by vested interests, and therefore people get a very distorted view of how the world works.
I remember Tim Tate talking about the conspiracy of silence on this programme, the documentary he made about child sexual abuse in the United States and the use of it for blackmailing politicians, saying that he was paid, or him and his team were paid $500,000 by the Discovery Channel for the documentary they'd made, which was then never broadcast.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have not looked into this in any detail, so I'm willing to listen to any kind of argument from any perspective about any of it. But you can't presume that just because somebody's made a film or a documentary or run a radio show, that that's the end of the argument in any shape or form.
Well, no one's saying it's the end, Martin. What I'm saying is that these kinds of documentaries are just not made at all now. In fact, even magazines like Private Eye poo-poo the idea that there could even be such a thing as satanic ritual abuse.
Well, one of the things I'd say about this, Tony, is I'm a political activist, and I try and concentrate on political matters. And the problem with mixing everything all up in a blender...
Well, that's not what we're doing here. We're talking specifically about satanic ritual abuse and evil.
Yeah, well, you're mentioning evil. That's okay. We can mention it. I'm very aware that the Western intelligence services, and probably not just them, have used child abuse as a blackmail tool. At Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, for example, it's well understood across the political spectrum what happened.
Well, this
there.
Amazingly sort of provides us in a way with a motivation, doesn't it, to do these things. I mean, people
That's
would
right.
think, well, surely no one would do that, but actually there can be enormous political gains from doing it.
Well, yes, there's a very there's means, motive, and opportunity. And we certainly know that they do use these kind of mechanisms.
Okay,
and,
so...
But individual allegations have to be individually looked at. You can't just presume in a blanket way that we know exactly what's going on. Because, of course, we don't.
We're putting bits of the jigsaw together, and I suppose looking at this in the light of the fact that no one is really able to make programmes like this anymore, certainly not for the mainstream press. And just it's just amazing, I think, listening to that 1989 documentary. Certainly for people now, they would never see something like that on television. But back in 1989, it did. It was ran out on 60 Minutes all over Australia. So we'll finish tonight with this clip from David Livingston. The longer interview he did is called The Occult Empire, the goals of that, and it's called Order from Chaos. His book is The Dying God, and this is what he's got to say about the evil he believes is that out there in the world today, and the actual motivation, I suppose, around chaos and madness to bring about a one-world totalitarian government. I mean, that's what he calls it, not a socialist government, as William Cooper does, just simply a totalitarian global system.
If we want to understand what is the Quran teaching us when it teaches us that the devil is out to destroy us, what does that look like? So what do we need to look out for? What it seems to look like is that this long-term plan, which has started out with the Magi, with Neoplatonism, with the Sufis, the Brethren of Sincerity, with the Templars, the Rosicrucians, the Masons, has been this slow growth of this underground occult movement, which has gained momentum and finally succeeded in 1776 and 1789 in the American and French revolutions, and basically the first occult orders that were created in the world. And they are using those as the vanguard to advance this plan, which is what Albert Pike calls the magnum opus, which is to fulfill the book of Revelation, to construct the third temple, which is supposed to herald the arrival, I guess the Messiah is supposed to come and build the third temple. So this expected Messiah is clearly the Dajjal. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They are working towards bringing about the arrival of the Dajjal. In fact, the whole point of Kabbalah...
He's talking about Dajjal here, which is the Muslim equivalent of the Antichrist.
The particularity of the Kabbalah of Isaac Luria from the 1500s, who explained, and all Kabbalah since is based on his version, is that you don't sit around and wait for the Messiah. You have to actively work to bring about his arrival. So this is what order out of chaos means, order out of chaos. That if the conditions described in the book of Revelation and other prophecies describe chaos preceding the arrival of this Messiah, then of course you, in their understanding, you have to sow chaos. So if there's supposed to be wars, deception, famine, destruction, then you have to create those events because they will herald, and this is the Luciferian version So, and this is what Dugin says. So Dugin says in his own words that the book of Revelation is not so much a prophecy, it's a task. So these are Luciferians who relish chaos. They believe that good is found in destruction, in mayhem, in blood, in suffering. You know, the satanic ritual is, you know, I'm sorry to say, but a satanic ritual often involves the slaughter of a child, the slaughter of a baby, right? I mean, so for them, that kind of horror gets them excited, right? They've gone over to the dark side. They feel that they have the psychological fortitude to be able to handle it, and they get sucked into it. And so that kind of violence, it makes them feel like they are powerful. So they will basically hold back no lengths that they will go to of the kind of mayhem and destruction that they will create in order to sow the chaos that they believe is necessary to create the preconditions for the arrival of the Messiah.
So he's calling it the Messiah. Some will call it the Antichrist or the Dajjal in the Islam. You just heard there from David Livingstone. He's the author of The Dying God, also the book Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, which I would thoroughly recommend, which really describes this kind of modern fascism, the idea that you can use computers and technology to engineer humanity in whichever way you wish. And what we're seeing, I think, a lot with the idea of these ID passports, that kind of thing. So, time to sign off. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Liberal Lib Dem Councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Thanks also to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and studio engineer Dave Bozanko. You can download our MP3s, listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Sunday evenings at 6 on BCFM with Danny Lopsch, and even on Sunday lunchtime at noon on the Richie Allen channel. You can get that at richieallen.co.uk. Apparently rebroadcasting our show every week from Sunday. So do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday, where we'll be joined by Republican Labour activist Martin Summers again. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.